Tuesday, President Trump noted how a transgender woman beat a real woman in a race by more than 5 hours. And he would have won by 7, but he got lost. And since he's a guy, he refused to ask for directions.
Boy, we have a lot of crazy fun stuff. And in some cases, just crazy stuff to talk about. So that crazy congressman, Al
Green. Is the one that's getting censured?
Yes. Yeah. Al Green was censured by the U.S. House of Representatives. By the way, the congressman who filed the motion to censure, again, that's censure, as in officially condemn the actions of Al Green, was Washington Republican Dan Newhouse.
You know, I did see a reference to that.
That was his resolution.
He initiated everything.
Okay. And normally when you are censured by your colleagues, it's a pretty serious thing. It's a big deal. And it's usually a solemn occasion. You're essentially being officially, your actions officially condemned by your colleagues. And yet, Al Green stood there waving his cane in the air, and about 20 of his more left-wing colleagues stood and started singing, "We Shall Overcome." Okay. Which shows just how far gone these people are. "We Shall Overcome" is a civil rights anthem. It was sung regularly during the civil rights rallies, protests, marches of the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. And, of course, has a time-honored history. "We Shall Overcome," back in the days when blacks in certain parts of this country could not use the same drinking fountain, could not use the same bathroom, could not eat at the same restaurants. And here is Al Green. He shall overcome what? The rule against trying to disrupt an invited speaker's address to a joint session of Congress? That's what he's trying to overcome? Peggy Noonan was a White House speechwriter during the Reagan era. She's no fan of Donald Trump. She's one of those anti-Trump Republicans, though she marvels at his political skill. Here's what she wrote in this morning's edition of the Wall Street Journal. "Democrats look like fools Tuesday night." This means how they behaved, including Al Green, but not limited to Al Green, during the president's epic speech on Tuesday. Anyway, let's get back to Peggy. "We don't need to dwell on how they sat grim-faced, seething, or walked out while the president spoke. One stood, yelled, brandished his cane, and was removed by the sergeant of arms." That's Al Green. "Others held up little paddles bearing little insults. Some wore special color-coded outfits. Almost all refused to show normal warmth or engagement. From my notes, as the camera turned and dwelled on their furious faces, I wrote, quote, 'They look like the green room in hell,' close quote. All while Donald Trump romped. Three thoughts," says Peggy Noonan. "One, these are not serious people. Two, their job was to show they are an alternative to Mr. Trump. Instead, they showed why he won. Third, and most important, they will continue to lose for a long time. I hadn't known that until Tuesday." Notice how she echoes John Carlson, Philip J. Vandenborn III, when she's, I said...
She's just following the trend.
that it's one thing when you lost an election. It's another when you behave like a loser.
And I think I threw in something like, this is what you do when you're out of ideas.
Yeah.
You know?
Sometimes, again, final paragraph here from Peggy Noonan. Sometimes a party takes a concussive blow, such as the 2024 presidential loss, and you can see they'll shape up and come back. They're pros. They lost an election, but not their dignity. But now and then you'll see, no, these guys don't know what happened. They're going to lose over and over again before they get the message. And she goes into how there were moments in President Trump's speech that had nothing to do with politics that really should have brought everyone together, including the people who don't like Donald Trump. She brings up the little 13-year-old boy, DJ, who has brain cancer, always wanted to be a cop, and then was made an honorary Secret Service agent, laminated ID, wallet badge and all. She said, the child, surprised by the gesture, hugs the normally taciturn head of the Secret Service. The only thing you do because you are human is to cheer that child. And when the president honors a young man whose late father, a veteran and policeman, had inspired his wish to serve and his dreams of attending West Point, and the president during his speech recognizes him in the gallery and says he has some sway in the admissions office and that, young man, you are going to West Point. Peggy Noonan says, I not only got choked up when it happened, I'm choked up as I write. The boy with cancer high fives the young man who just learned he's going to West Point, and the only response to such sweetness is tears in your eyes. That moment is the love. It was showing love for regular Americans. To cheer them is to cheer us. It shows admiration for and affiliation with normal people who try, who get through, endure, and hold on to good hopes. But the Democrats brought the hate. They sat stone-faced, joyless, and loveless. They don't show love for Americans anymore. They look down on them, feel distance from them, instruct them, remind them to feel bad when they're surrounded by injustice, or remind them to feel bad that they're surrounded by injustice because, well, they're unjust. But Mr. Trump says, no, man, I love you. Which is better, she writes, which is kinder, more generous, which inspires, which wins? Democrats have to understand where they are. They have completely lost their reputation as the party of the working man. With their bad governance of major cities, their airy, abstract obsessions with identity politics and gender ideology, they have driven away the working class, for whom life is not airy or abstract. It's a great piece. Again, that is Peggy Noonan, not a pro-Trump journalist at all, but someone who calls it as she sees it, and boy, she called this one spot on. She is, oh, absolutely right. All right, we got a lot of stuff happening on the commute with Carlson. Sometimes I talk about local issues. Sometimes I talk about national issues. Sometimes I talk about global issues. Right now, I'm going to talk about all three at once. Two, active duty, JBLM soldiers, that's Joint Base Lewis McChord, are in custody, accused of spying for China. Like I said, local, they're both from Fort Lewis. National, in the military. Global, they're spies, allegedly.
Yeah, international spying.
Here's Como 4's Ryan Sims explaining the espionage investigation. You're going to hear the voice and comments of the lead FBI investigator in Seattle on this case. Have a listen.
According to these charging papers, Jian Zhao, Li Tian, and Ryoyu Duan are accused of deliberately risking the lives of their fellow troops, all in exchange for money from the people based in China.
It demonstrates the pervasive nature of the threat from the government of China to our national security.
This investigation hinges on at least 20 stolen military hard drives, as well as a stolen encrypted computer.
Once you've compromised your integrity, then you are compromised. And the individual knows that as well as the adversary.
The FBI isn't sharing the specifics of what exactly was leaked to the suspect's contacts in China. They say some of the data is top secret and included info about military planning and the military's capabilities. Fire! Information that, in the wrong hands, the FBI says could have gotten our troops hurt or killed.
This is something that really is personal to me because before I joined the FBI, I was stationed at then Fort Lewis, now Joint Base Lewis McChord. I was one of the soldiers that could have been endangered by this type of activities.
Activity that FBI agents say could eventually lead to decades of prison time.
Wow. Okay, so currently I believe they're facing charges for espionage. Depending what's on that computer, they could be looking at treason. What is the difference between the two? Well, a traitor is someone who helps an enemy of his country. Espionage is assisting someone who is trying to acquire unlawfully information about this country, which may or may not be used by an enemy. So, again, espionage is spying, usually on another nation, to get secret information. And treason is crossing the street into helping someone who is trying, who is actively hostile to the United States, and you're helping them. So we'll see what's on that computer and what these guys could be facing in the way of charges. All this $15,000 bribe by China. When we learn more about this, we will tell you. Oh, all right. We've got a lot of stuff happening on the John Carlson Show. Bob Ferguson reverses a climate agenda position by Jay Inslee. What's going on there? Again, another surprise by Bob Ferguson. In some ways, Bob Ferguson is demonstrating the difference between a liberal and a progressive leftist. Inslee was a progressive leftist. He didn't spend a single moment in office trying to reduce government waste. He didn't spend a moment in office trying to grant tax relief when he had massive surpluses, which meant that people had overpaid for government. Almost every other state in the country, while Inslee was governor, did offer tax relief of one kind or another at some point or another. Inslee did not. All he did was add to the government. And he signed every liberal and left-wing bill that was passed. So again, Bob Ferguson, who started out in office saying we can't tax our way out of this revenue shortfall that was created when Inslee created a budget or crafted a budget that he knew was unsustainable, meaning he said, here's your budget, knowing full well that the amount of money coming in wouldn't cover it. So we'll get into how Bob Ferguson is once again taking a position that probably has Jay Inslee fulminating and has Republicans pleasantly surprised.
Nice word. Nice use of the word fulminating.
Yeah.
I did not have that on my bingo card for this Friday morning.
We have a brand new Secretary of Education who says that her cabinet-level department should no longer exist. You would think the Democrats are going to absolutely run for daylight. Hey, look, the Republicans are anti-education. They're trying to cancel the Department of Education. How do Americans feel about moving power when it comes to education away from Washington, D.C.? Believe it or not, we've got a poll that's not getting a lot of attention. I think it deserves attention. And the outrage of the day. Remember that story about the illegal alien in New York City who set a woman on fire in the subway? She burned to death in the subway.
Unfortunately, I do.
He didn't know who she was. He just
unprovoked
wanted
right?
to set her on fire. She burned to death. New York City says they will not honor a detainer request from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to remove this illegal from the United States. Absolutely outrageous. We got details on that straight ahead as well. Philip J. Vandenbort III with the social media sweep. What's going on, Phil?
Social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. To start with some hard news here, the social media sweep. This comes out of Whatcom County. I'm looking at a post from Channel 7 News, Cairo 7 News. Mexican citizen, former sex offender, indicted on child pornography charges. Oh, check it. It's in Bothell. Here's a little bit more about the story.
What's happened?
The Mexican national has been accused of child pornography in the state of Washington. WhatsApp. This is a text messaging app that's commonly used to tie together people who might want to text each other from different continents, things like that, but can also be done domestically here in the States. I'm on a WhatsApp with some parents on my son's soccer football team. But WhatsApp officials, they ended up getting an alert of sexually explicit images that had been uploaded on WhatsApp. And the subject's name, Jamie Neri Soto. After surveillance, Bothell police ended up arresting Neri Soto. Neri Soto is scheduled for arraignment coming up next week, March 13th. And 8 years ago, Neri Soto was deported back to Mexico from the United States. So despite being deported, managed to get back into the United States and now is going to be facing child pornography charges.
So here's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Will we honor the ICE detainer?
Depending on what part of Bothell, it potentially could be Snohomish County, but
Washington could be
King County.
Washington is a sanctuary state.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So will we honor an ICE detainer to get a child pornographer, allegedly, who has previously been deported? Will we put this person into ICE's hands? Every politician should be asked that question. Should we cooperate with ICE to remove this accused child pornographer, caught in the act, as it were, from the United States? I would love to take him into ICE custody.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would love to see that question answered.
Defend your policy, Democrats.
Yeah.
Right?
This is no longer hypothetical. This is no longer theoretical. This is a real live case. A real live illegal who had previously been deported, who came back here for the purposes of distributing, and who knows how he was involved in child pornography.
For whatever reason, is back in the States, and this is the activity the individual is allegedly up to. Now, Seattle Times apparently has a food podcast. Okay, not a big deal. But the subject matter of the food podcast involved Seattle restaurants and how they account for the rising cost of labor. That is known as the increase in the minimum wage.
Right.
And it also seems to say, there's a little bit more about it. One of the headlines for it is egg selling question, how do Seattle restaurants stay afloat in 2025? So it hit on that too. And a former, I believe that Hannah Krieg is a former Stranger writer in Seattle.
Yeah, she is.
Hannah Krieg's bio does not say anything about the Stranger anymore, so that part has been modified from her social media profile.
Where's she camped out these days?
I have no idea. I'm not positive. Okay. So maybe she's freelance.
All right.
She's an independent writer. But Hannah Krieg reposted the Seattle Times thing about the rising labor costs and wrote, rising cost of labor this, rising cost of labor that. Can restaurants channel half as much energy into complaining about rising rent? Or is it more fun to punch down at your workers than punch up at your landlord? How revealing is that? And economically clueless.
Says a left-wing journalist who has obviously never opened a restaurant.
Yeah.
Who's never had to make a payroll.
And the Puget Sound Business Journal adds a story that Cheesecake Factory, which is there right by the convention center, I think it's 6th and Pike or Pine.
It was one in Bellevue Square.
Okay.
As well,
yeah. Cheesecake Factory is going to close down a downtown Seattle restaurant.
Oh, not the one in Bellevue.
So,
I wonder why.
Yeah. So, again, Hannah Krieg, talk to us again about all these costs, okay?
Yeah. And tell us about what the workers have to say who aren't having to settle for a lower wage or not a higher wage than you want them to have, but no longer have a job.
Yeah, or fewer hours because of all that.
No longer have a job at the Cheesecake Factory in Seattle. Very nice. Great report, Philip J. Vandervoort III. When we come back, okay, what's the current story on tariffs? We're going to try and clear up this confusion because the news is confusing. This is why I'm here, to try and clear it all up, clarify it for you as our Friday continues here on The Commute with Carlson. As far as you're concerned, Donald Trump, he did campaign on a pledge to enact tariffs on our neighbors, on Canada and Mexico, if they did not do more to stem the flow of illegal drugs and illegal aliens into this country. Sure enough, the president, after threatening and feigning that he was about to do it, did pull the trigger and ordered 25% tariffs on all goods that were covered by what's called the USMCA. The USMCA was a replacement for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Treaty, that Donald Trump said was a terrible deal. So he negotiated a better one. All right. The president had those tariffs in place for maybe a day before he stopped and pulled back on the automobile industry. This was following meetings he had with the chief executives of Ford, GM, and Stellantis, in which the big three committed that they would be moving supply chains back from Mexico and Canada to the United States. But he said, all right, we will take off the tariffs. And we'll take another look on April 2nd. All right. Now, the president has expanded his exemptions. And he's pulling back entirely. So Basically, he's giving Mexico and Canada a one-month reprieve from 25% tariffs. A 25% tariff means, let's say you're selling something from Mexico or Canada into the United States that costs $100. Okay, the tariff is a tax. It says if you want this good to enter the United States, it now will cost $125. Because obviously the tariff will be passed along in higher costs. So what would have cost someone $100 that came from Mexico or Canada is now going to cost $125. This is the second time in a month that President Trump has stepped away from these tariffs. And Canada, for its part, says it would not proceed with retaliatory tariffs that were set to be levied against the United States later this March. But they did leave in place $21 billion in tariffs on fruits and vegetables, appliances, and liquor. The stock market doesn't like what they are seeing, and we, of course, expected that that would happen. Because what markets love is stability. And when you're imposing a tariff, that's going to shake things up. And when you impose a tariff and then pull back on it and then say we might put it back on in 4 weeks, that's going to make the markets quake a little bit. What is the reason for the tariffs? Again, the president was very clear. Stop illegal drugs coming across our border. Stop illegal aliens coming across our border. Now, there is some good news to tell on this front. I've been telling you this entire week and even last week that the southern border has seen a 97% drop in illegal immigration. Not 90% drop. Not 95% drop. 97% drop. It's free fallen. At one point when Joe Biden was president, 10 to 11,000 illegals a day were caught at the border and then mostly released into the country. Because, again, that's what the Biden administration wanted. They wanted an open border. They wanted to bring as many people from other countries into this country as possible. They don't like the current complexion of the United States. They didn't care that it also meant a huge increase in fentanyl and other drugs and human trafficking and other contraband as well. They knew this was happening because it was publicized. It was a news story. They did nothing to change the law. The only thing that made them change the law is when suddenly they realized that what was a complete non-issue when they took office, the border, it was a non-issue. Trump had already effectively sealed the border. If the Democrats did everything else that they did for the last 4 years except the border, if they had just kept Trump's policies in place on the border and did everything out the, you know, misnamed Inflation Reduction Act, you know, all of the DEI nonsense, you know, they may have actually won the election. But so many problems were created on so many fronts in so many places from illegal immigration and their strident refusal to take personal responsibility for it, that illegal immigration, the border, the problems associated with the border, became the first or second most important issue in the campaign. That's how badly they handled the border. They actually made a non-issue the first or second most important issue. The first, in most places, was the economy, rising prices. But the border was surprisingly strong as a second major issue on the minds of American voters. So, we now, again, that great line, if you could find that line, Phil, and replay it, it was just the one of the great moments from President Trump's speech, where Trump said, we kept hearing that the previous administration said it needed a law to get control of the border. Turns out we didn't need a new law. We just needed a new president. And the House came down on that. I mean, it was just a huge, huge ovation. And it had, as I often say when I talk about politics, the added virtue of being true.
Ask and you shall receive.
The media and our friends in the Democrat Party kept saying we needed new legislation. We must have legislation to secure the border. But it turned out that all we really needed was a new president.
All right, drop the mic. Game, set, and match, Mr. Trump. Anyway, the point
another
here,
one.
The point is that the border now, thanks to Donald Trump and to the pressure he has brought on President Sheinbaum in Mexico, and by the way, on Prime Minister Trudeau in Canada, we don't have much of an illegal immigration problem, but we had a growing illegal immigration problem. The borders are in really great shape. We went from 11,000 a day during the peak of this catastrophe during the Biden years to, I believe it was 229. And they, by the way, were swiftly kicked out. Whereas at one point, 11,000 a day were coming in. Joe Biden was simply processing them, not even vetting them, of course, just processing them and letting them into the country. So part of what the president wants, you know, Mexico has sent 10,000 troops to the border. Mexico has shown signs of cracking down on drug cartels. I think the news that we have sent or are sending a striker brigade, 3,000 U.S. troops headed for the southern border to take on the cartels, I think that has had a boost that has helped. So most of the problems that President Trump is most concerned about are, if they're not solved, they're moving rapidly in the right direction. And that's what matters most. They're moving in the right direction. All right. So that's where we are on the tariffs. Lars Larson, we still have a few weeks left together, buddy.
Yeah, we do. And I just can't believe that you're going to be hanging it up. I mean, I'm just marking 50 years as of this month. So I kind of thought you were going to be around for a long
50
time.
50 years? You've been telling everyone you're 54 years old. You did not start when you were 4 years of age.
I started when I was 16.
Yes. Yeah, no, I didn't get into it until my 20s, 30s.
You had offices to run for. You had politics. You had all of the rest of that. Yeah. But by the way, are we now probably not going to get that new advertising contract for KVI with Perkins Coie, the big Seattle law? You think there's any chance we can salvage that despite the fact that Trump cut them off yesterday?
I will tell you something very interesting.
All right.
I actually know several Perkins attorneys, and they're good people. I mean, they're great people, and a couple of them are on our side. The guy who was responsible for the notorious Steele dossier and kind of laundering that. He was notorious. His name is Mark Elias.
And he still is notorious. He's left.
Yes.
Didn't he leave Perkins?
He left Perkins, not on the most pleasant of terms. And he is the kind of guy who tries and gets away with all sorts of election shenanigans and then will sue other states if they try and do the same things. I mean, the guy is just a strident partisan. Well, and
do they still teach in law school that if you lie down with pigs, you're likely to get up dirty?
Well, I'll tell you, he's got his own gig going. But, yeah, Perkins Coie, which is a Seattle-based law firm, it has offices all over the country and I think in several other nations as well. They are any of their attorneys who have clearance, who have a security clearance, are now having it scrapped.
And imagine
they've
how
lost
that,
their security
that impedes
clearance.
Your work. If you need to have a security clearance to be able to, you know, consult with certain contracts, and Boeing probably has a lot of contracts that would require that. Although I think, doesn't Perkins still do mostly politics, or do they do business as well?
Oh, no. They do. Actually, they do mostly business. They were best known for being Boeing's outside law firm.
Well, there you go. No security clearance. I guess you can work on any airplanes or military contracts that don't involve security clearances, whatever that is.
So there's something I wanted to ask you about real quickly.
Sure.
The tariff issue. Okay.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Donald Trump has announced 25% tariffs. We were just talking about this a second ago. And now he's kind of pulling back for a month. He says the main reason for doing it is he's tired of the fentanyl and other illegal drugs, and he's tired of illegal aliens crossing the border north and south. We are making progress, big-time progress, mostly because of Trump and Tom Homan, but also because Trudeau up north and Sheinbaum south in Mexico have adjusted their policies under pressure from the White House. What do you think the future is going to be of these tariffs? Do you think that he will reimpose them? He's temporarily lifted them in April, or do you think he will be satisfied with what's happening at the border?
I think he'll be satisfied for now, but remember, this is carrot and stick. You have to have both. You have to be prepared to deploy both, and the people that you're negotiating with have to believe you'll use them. And if, as long as they believe that and they act accordingly, I mean, I don't think this is unfair. When Canada tariffs milk coming into Canada at 300%, the stuff that comes in from America, and they dump literally billions of gallons of milk because they have a screwed up system run by the government on milk. So they dump billions of dollars
to
worth of milk every year
the price
and then tariff ours.
To keep the price up.
Yeah.
They dump milk to artificially constrict the supply. No,
then deny their own citizens the ability to buy good, wholesome, all-American USA milk. You've got to buy the socialist Canada milk instead. Sorry.
But what did you make of the Democrats while one of their own, Al Green, was being censured for repulsive conduct at the president's speech, waving his cane around, bellowing, standing around him singing "We Shall Overcome" while he's being censured?
Outrageous, although when they voted to censure, there were some Democrats from the Northwest who joined them.
Yes, including the one, I think, of the 3rd District, Perez. By the way, I think the reaction to how the Democrats conducted themselves on the floor of the House during the censure, they should strip Al Green of his committee assignments.
I agree.
I don't think the censure goes far enough. I don't think they're taking it seriously enough. They'll take losing his committee assignments seriously, though. Just the other day, we had Brian Haywood joining us from Let's Go Washington. Brian Haywood, of course, the man we can all thank for 4 landmark initiatives becoming law in Washington State in just the last year. No one's ever done 4 initiatives before. So Brian Haywood, again, already making history here in Washington State. Good morning, Brian Haywood. How are you?
Good morning, John Carlson. I'm doing really well.
All right. And he joined us the just day before yesterday because one of those four initiatives that was made law, the legislature is already trying to dismantle. When the people pass an initiative, you can't touch it for 2 years. But when the legislature votes through an initiative that's qualified for the ballot, then they can start tinkering with it almost immediately. That's what they are doing with the landmark initiative 2081. That's the Parents' Right to Know initiative. Now they got a brand new one that is, as the legislature tries to dismantle 2081, that would repeal what the legislature is trying to dismantle. And there's all sorts of mischief already happening in the state capitol. Brian Haywood, give us an update.
Good morning. Well, that's exactly right. There were two bills to try to dismantle 2081. One of them was 1296 that was in the House, and one of them was 5181 in the Senate. There's a cutoff date when these bills have to move forward, and 1296, which was in the House, which was a much worse bill, was left in committee. In other words, it didn't advance forward. But the Speaker of the House has the ability to pull that out any time. And what's really interesting is when we filed our initiative to repeal 5181, they suddenly decided we're going to pull 1296 and bring it back to the floor.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So basically, they would say, oh, we're no longer passing Senate Bill 5181. We're passing a different bill. And so they would be able to dodge your initiative, which is a very short initiative.
So they think they're being smart, or that like somehow we wouldn't figure that out or wouldn't anticipate it. We'll have another initiative here filed in the appropriate time to respond to whichever one moves forward.
Can I make a suggestion, Brian?
Yes, please.
Why don't you just refile Initiative 2081?
That's an option. That's what I'm saying. There might be.
So no matter what they do. No matter what they do, doesn't matter. You're not going to have to wait till the end of session to see what they do and lose valuable time. Just refile 2081.
And make it clear. The big challenge we've got to make sure is that if we did that, their attack on 2081 the first time was to say, well, there's already these laws that we have in place, and this new initiative, which became law and replaced them, doesn't really replace them because we already have laws in place. So they've been playing games, word games with this from the very beginning. So whatever we do needs to make sure that it addresses directly those word games that they're playing.
You know what? Even better. That's a great point you make, Brian Haywood. And that is they are playing games with not enforcing it anyway. You can always reshape and refashion with specialists, Washington Parents Network, Family Policy Institute of Washington, get together with them, put together a model initiative that will compel the state of Washington to respect parents. And just regardless of what you jokers in Olympia are doing, thinking you're so clever, this is going to be the initiative going forward. This is the initiative you didn't want on the ballot because it would get 70% approval from the voters, and you knew it, and you were afraid it was going to sink some of your candidates running for re-election. So this is our response to your bad faith behavior in Olympia, is we're taking our case directly to the people.
That is definitely one of the options we're considering.
Good. That is excellent. And again, I want to commend people to go to two great websites. The first is letsgowashington.com. That's letsgowashington.com, or even letsgowa.com. Gets you to the same place and gives you the latest update on what Brian is talking about. The other is my new favorite media website that I've been telling KVI listeners about. Haywire, HEYWIRE.org. Haywire.org, which is a news aggregate service, meaning it gives you dozens and dozens of stories from what's happening in Washington State from all different elements of the news media. And then you scroll down a little bit and they give you over 50 different media sites, online, newspapers, TV, radio stations, prominent people in the media. Look, there I am, the John Carlson Show. It's all at haywire.org. That's HEYWIRE.org. You've got to check it out. Haywire.org and letsgowashington.com. Brian Haywood, let's stay in touch. This drama continues.
Yeah, everybody be ready to fight, and we'll let everybody know, update as this fight moves forward.
Oh, they'll be ready. This is going to be a good one. This is going to be a really good one. All right. Thanks very much for making time on short notice to join us, give us this needed review of what's happening by the minute in Olympia.
Well, thank you, sir, and have a great day.
You got to have a good weekend. Brian Haywood, Let's Go Washington. All right. It is 10 minutes after 7 o'clock. Here's an interesting lawsuit. A longtime Starbucks manager is suing Starbucks for discrimination, retaliation, and intentional infliction of emotional distress, accusing his superiors at the company of ignoring extreme and outrageous harassment he suffered because he is straight. Chris Famenson, that's Chris Favinson, is a regular guy, a heterosexual, gender-typical guy in Rochester, New York, says that his supervisors at his location at the Rochester Starbucks treated him in a materially different manner than gay employees. This, according to a lawsuit filed under New York's state human rights law. Remember, if it's illegal to discriminate against someone based on sexual orientation, that applies to men and women who are gay, but it also applies to men and women who are straight. Lest you think that Mr. Favinson is a, you know, 19-year-old, overly emotional Gen Zer. No, no, no. He's 47 years of age, has worked at Starbucks for a long time, serves, according to his legal complaint, as a model employee who performed the essential functions of his employment in exemplary fashion. It contends that his LGBTQ plus co-workers created a hostile work environment for him because of his, quote, gender typicality and sexual orientation, close quote. When he complained, he was fired. When he complained to higher-ups at the company, he was fired. Reached by phone yesterday, Mr. Favinson, who is a person of color and is now working at a bank, said he wanted to speak with his attorney. His attorney told The Independent that he believes that his client's heterosexuality had been weaponized against him. Quote, management at Starbucks was indifferent to his complaints, claiming that workers in the store and the surrounding area were attempting to drive out their straight employee, their straight colleagues. In other words, they wanted an all LGBTQ Starbucks. And they were trying to drive him out. Messages seeking comment were sent to a Starbucks spokesperson. This, in many ways, mirrors another high-profile case brought by a woman named Marlene Ames from Ohio, who sued the Ohio Department of Youth Services, arguing that she was denied a promotion because she was not lesbian. And then she was demoted and replaced by a gay man. She has taken her case to the Supreme Court. But again, keep in mind, we are, if you cannot discriminate against someone because of sexual orientation, this also applies to people who are straight. Mr. Thevenson had been managing that Starbucks store for 10 years. Most of the employees at the store he oversaw were members of the, quote, LGBTQ plus community, he contends in his lawsuit. At all relevant times, Mr. Thevenson was harassed by the staff due to his sex or sexual orientation in the course of his employment. Management had a duty to provide him with, quote, a safe environment in which to do his job free of harassment. They breached that duty. And in so doing, they aided, abetted, tolerated, condoned, and facilitated the harassment against him. The harassment was so frequent and pervasive that it altered Mr. Thevenson's employment conditions and created a hostile work environment. The complaint accuses upper management at Starbucks of negligently failing to supervise the workers. So this looks to be like an attempt by a collection, a collusion of LGBTQ employees to drive this guy out. So we will see where this complaint goes. Very interesting. Again, he had worked at the Starbucks since 2014 and was in his 40s. Starbucks says he was disciplined for what Mr. Thevenson says were ginned up unspecified violations. Ultimately, he was discharged, but was given, quote, several different conflicting reasons for why. So this looks like, instead of being guided by the law, which says you don't discriminate based on someone's sexual orientation, this is an example of Starbucks, if Mr. Thevenson's complaint is accurate, of simply trying to be pro-gay rather than observing someone's rights. This, again, will be very interesting, and it's a sign, once again, that we are now living in a culture where people are pushing back. They're pushing back for being mistreated simply because they are everyday, ordinary people. And you've got to understand, to the progressive left, everyday, ordinary people are an annoyance. If they don't belong to a preferred class, i.e. LGBTQ or trans, various some but not all races, then you don't deserve the equal protection of the law. That is the ideology of the left, not to be pro-civil rights, but to be pro-black, pro-Hispanic, pro-gay, etc. If you have a free country where you want people treated equally, then you have a single standard that applies to all. That is what the left is at war with. They are literally trying to turn the core principles of civil rights in America, the civil rights movement. Treat people the way you want to be treated. Treat people equally. They're trying to turn that upside down and treat people differently precisely because of their race or their gender or their gender identity or LGBTQ plus status. That could be what this is about. All right. 7:20 in the morning already. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner of the social media sweep.
And we're talking about daylight savings time. So this is your obligatory reminder from your favorite media, news media outlet, that roll the clock forward, push the clock forward Saturday night into Sunday. We move forward for daylight saving times. So news-wise, let's go to what Governor Bob Ferguson posted on social media. And he posted two different items related to his announcement yesterday about trying to get more ferry boats back on the water across Puget Sound. One of the posts says, "My North Star," as in his guiding light, "my North Star is to restore our ferry service to pre-pandemic levels. Our communities who rely on ferries to access healthcare, school, work, are counting on us to address this crisis." Really? It only took this long? I mean, he was silent as the attorney general, the top law enforcement officer in this state,
yeah,
when Jay Inslee was dismantling everything or basically crippling everything. Ferguson then also added another post on social media.
It's clear what he did is he just quietly laid low on a lot of this stuff,
right?
Rather than pick a fight with Inslee while he was serving, in order to maintain unified Democrat support while he ran for governor.
Yeah, or is he just late to realizing the reality of the awful decisions that Jay Inslee made? I mean, I can't tell if he was just running cover, like you were kind of talking about, or if he's just that clueless. So, and then the other post that he added, "I announced that by this summer, we expect to have 18 ferries back on the water for the first time since 2019. Under my plan, we expect to be operating full service through World Cup 2026. That would be the summer of 2026. Right now, commuters who travel by ferry between Bremerton and Seattle, one of the state's busiest ferry routes, must wait more than 2 hours between boats every day. Mark Christopher, the radio legend who helps run your show, mm-hmm. he talks about this all the time. Used to be two-boat service. Mm-hmm. It's been one-boat service. You have to wait twice as long." And he says, "We're addressing the crisis and making things happen." Wow. It's a miracle he couldn't have said or done any of these things or urged any of these things years ago.
I tell you, though, I'm going to take the better late than never view. Imagine how the Dems are reacting to this. Imagine how Inslee is reacting to this.
Yeah, that would be great to get his perspective.
I mean, this is Ferguson is reversing. First of all, he's pretty much acknowledging that Inslee had been a failure when it came to the ferry system. Mm-hmm. The second thing he's doing is he reversed his conversion of ferries to hybrids, which would be incredibly expensive and is just nothing but cheap. No, not cheap virtue signaling, expensive virtue signaling.
Very, very expensive. And, hasn't been done before, and so the process is taking twice as long, if not longer, to get accomplished.
It was now, supposed to take a year. They said, oh, did we say 1 year? We meant three.
Yeah.
And said, you know what? Just put the boats back in the water. Get people to where they're trying to get to go.
And then this kind of comes to a text message that came in on the text line. And Steve wrote and asked or says, Ferguson is planning to run for president in 2028, so he's pretending to be moderate.
Who
do
knows?
Do you want to respond to that or should I?
No, who knows? And if he is, then what a gift. We get 4 years of a moderately liberal governor instead of a progressive, crazy governor like Jay Inslee, because we've got a progressive, crazy legislature. So if he's going to be a break on the madness in the House and Senate, where they want to make it harder for law-abiding people to purchase a firearm while simultaneously supporting legislation to restore the right to buy a gun for drug felons, for crying out loud. If he's going to be a break on that kind of madness, that's something we didn't expect.
I can see Ferguson running for president, just not in 2028. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's going to happen in 2028 either. But I do think that Ferguson understands that people's patience with the progressive left is rapidly wearing thin. All right, it's 7:30, the John Carlson Show. You know, we have Steve Moore going to be joining us on the commute, our frequent Fox News guest, and of course our chief economist. Also, Cheryl Atkinson.
You can do what you want to us, but we're not going to sit here and listen to you bad mouth the United States of America. Gentlemen.
Steve Moore, good morning. How are you?
Hey, John, good. And I do remember when the Germans dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor. So, great line from our favorite movie, yes. Animal House.
That's right. When the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor.
life is good. We need to get this tax cut passed. That's my mantra these days. Why are they taking so long to do it? The economy does need a little bit of a pick-me-up. We got a jobs report this morning.
Yes.
You may have seen it. It was a decent report, but I do worry the economy is slowing down a little bit, and this is the what I call the hangover effect from Bidenomics. You know, he spent every single penny he could get his hands on in the last 3 months in office, and, you know, it's like, you know, when you go, you never do this, John, but I'm known to maybe go out partying every now and then and drinking maybe a little too much and then end up dancing on the tables, and then I can't get out of bed in the morning. And that's sort of what Trump is facing right now today. You know, it's the hangover from all the government spending and hiring. The best news in the jobs report was that for the first time in probably your and my lifetime, the federal government actually laid off government employees rather than hired them.
Yes. Yes. And very interesting what Harry Enten is reporting on CNN. Listen, if you hadn't seen this, he's examining the latest polling data from the CBS poll about DOGE and about
how people
feel about government spending.
It's amazing.
Let me play this real short clip.
This, to me, was one of the more shocking figures that I saw. Made me go, wait a minute, hold on one second. Whoa, Americans on Trump and Joe's efforts. Musk and Doge should influence government spending and operations. Look at this. 54%, the majority say that he and they should. How about approve of Trump trying to cut staff at government agencies? Again, you get a majority here, 51%. So yeah, Elon Musk might not be that popular, but these cuts and the idea of spending cuts, at least within the federal government and cutting at government agencies, that actually has majority support. I was truly surprised by this, Kate, but the numbers are the numbers.
There you go, Steve Moore.
And that came from CNN, right?
CNN's polling director, Harry Enten.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, that wasn't Fox News. That was CNN, which is, you know, I worked, as you know, for a year and a half at CNN. And it was me against eight people on the other side every time I went on. So for CNN to admit that, and by the way, when he was saying that, all the people on the CNN set were frowning. You know, like, how dare you say anything good about Trump and Doge?
We know how.
I also agree with that analysis that people may not like, Elon Musk, but they do like what he's doing.
Right.
You know, and same, and that is, I think we all understand that we've got a big, obese, fat, inefficient government. And it's been, we've waited 40 years for somebody to come in and get rid of the inefficiency. And why are liberals supporting bad government? Why do they support fraud?
Because they don't care about good or bad government. They simply want bigger government.
Yes. But you know what? I think it goes beyond that, John. I think you only have it half right there. The other thing that we're discovering is that a lot of the fraud money, it went right into their pocketbooks.
Well, this latest revelation that the EPA was, after Joe Biden lost, was rushing out $20 billion.
Billion
with a B, much of it which went to nonprofits that had only been formed the year before.
Right. And by the way, most of those nonprofits were also started by people who had worked in the agencies under Biden, then went out in the, quote, private sector. I've got air quotes there with my fingers.
Yes.
The private sector, because they were just adjuncts of government. And then they were taking all this money. And if, I think you and I mentioned this the other
time. You know who else got donors.
Donors were
associated with these nonprofits.
Yeah, so it was a cash-in, cash-out system. But the most outrageous story, and this is something happened about 10 days ago, but the media kind of glossed over it. One of the most self-righteous members of the Congress is this guy, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island.
Rhode Island, yes.
And I cannot stand this guy. And he's always sermonizing about how much he cares about poor people and how much he cares about climate change. And he's always attacking, you know, anyone with a conservative point of view because he's holier than thou. Well, it turns out, that this holier than thou senator got I don't remember the exact number, but something like a $20 million earmark for a program for a private, you know, one of these private, nonprofit organizations. And guess who got $4 million of that money? His wife. I mean, that's graft.
Yeah. But that should be senatorial misconduct.
That's criminal.
I was going to say,
he should be in jail for that. And here's the thing. The ethics committee in the Senate looked at it and said, nah, nothing wrong here.
What?
I'm not kidding. They give him a little slap on the wrist.
Oh, that, in my opinion, compounds the outrage.
Exactly. Yes, it does. And so anyway, that's Washington for you, folks. And,
okay.
You know, what's the old saying that people come to Washington to do good and they end up doing well? And I've seen it for 40 years.
So I want to bring up something else to you, because one of the other issues you have a passion for is education, particularly school choice moving authority out of Washington, D.C.
The
president has delayed his executive order on dismantling the Department of Education, but it's clear that Linda McMahon just confirmed to run that department knows that her marching orders are to send authority away from Washington, D.C., So get this. You would expect that Democrats will say, they're anti-education. They're trying to dismantle the Department of Education.
Right.
It proves they hate education. Rasmussen poll done for Napolitan News Service. 61% of voters favor transferring more control for schools to state education departments and local school boards. And away from the...
I've not seen that. Who did that poll?
It was done by Scott Rasmussen, Rasmussen Research for Napolitan
Amazing.
News Service.
Wow.
Get this. Only 29% oppose.
That's amazing. Well, you know, the thing is that I think they may be listening to people like you and I, because we've been saying that we've spent almost $1 trillion on the Department of Education since it was created by Jimmy Carter in 1979, I believe it was. $1 trillion. And over that time, what do you think has happened to test scores?
Well, we know.
They've gone down. Yeah. So show me where that money was. Show me the money. Show me the results.
Okay,
any indication that any of that money has had any positive effect, when the more we spend, the less results we get.
So let me again read you the polling question so you have it. It was, the poll was actually conducted just before the election. And the question asked, would you favor or oppose transferring more control for schools to state education departments and local school boards and away from the federal Department of Education? Favor, 61%. Oppose, 29%. Not sure, just 10%.
So, amazing. I had not seen that poll result, but it confirms what I thought. And I'm glad to see the Americans get it.
That's just money. They get it.
Yeah.
They get it.
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. There was a massive building down the street from where I stand right now, because, as you know, I'm a swamp creature myself. A massive education department building. And there's two things I got to tell you about it. One is that nobody in that's working in that agency is actually doing anything to have any impact on how the schools are doing in Seattle, Washington. I guarantee
right.
you.
Right.
Do you think any of that has any? Now, the second thing I'll tell you is there's nobody there.
Yeah, they're not even showing up for work.
They're not even showing up for work, which is might not be such a bad thing.
Yeah. I remember Milton Friedman once said, thank God government's so inefficient. Can you imagine what would happen to our liberty if they were efficient at what they really want to do?
Now, here, think about this, though, here to make a serious point.
Yes.
We spend, I think $100 billion a year, roughly $100 billion a year in the Department of Education. Trump's idea is, hey, I've got an idea. You know, we've got, let's say, a million kids or, more that are in failing schools. Why don't we just give the money to the parents and they can choose their school? Hey, what an idea. We can't possibly do that. Oh, no, that would be horrible.
Well, it gets back to what you were saying 2 weeks ago on the show about welfare. We spend twice as much money on welfare programs as it would actually cost to lift every person living in poverty above the poverty line.
Yeah.
So, again, with education,
people are not poor.
Same thing. Look at how much better our schools could be if we just gave the money directly to people to choose a better school for their kid. Steve Moore, man, it's always great hearing your voice here on the John Carlson Show. Looking forward to next week.
All right, John. Have a great weekend, my friend.
All right. Folks, it's Boeing time, 747, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Cheryl Atkinson, right around the corner on The Commute with Carlson. Cheryl Atkinson, host of Full Measure, national TV news magazine, and a really great one. Good morning, Cheryl. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good morning to you.
So you wrote a really great book that we've talked a lot about here on the show, and we even gave copies away, thanks to you, during the holidays,
that
called Follow the Science. So that is exactly what you are doing on this Sunday's episode of Full Measure. People are going to see what happens when you follow the science and you defend science against corporate interest. Do tell.
Well, this is a story about what can go on behind the scenes that you never hear about, your doctor doesn't know about, parents don't know about, when it comes to vaccines, given to almost every American child. And I just think it's a lesson in blind trust that I used to put into the system
right.
that's probably not deserved. And this is a story of it'll be told by a scientist who worked inside Merck years ago when he learned some disturbing things about the MMR vaccine. Merck was making the only one on the market back then.
Mm-hmm.
And what's more, he said that he was directed, as well as other scientists there, to change data to make things look better than they were about a controversy. So he ultimately, bravely, I think, called the FDA, became a whistleblower, and exposed a lot of this, but you never heard about it. This has been going on in court for 15 years. It's really fascinating. Merck says, I will add, its vaccine is safe and effective, and that they addressed all the problems that the FDA raised over this. But I think people are going to find this fascinating.
What became of the whistleblower?
Whatever becomes of the whistleblower, John. Of course, he lost his job, and he put on a really good fight in court for over 15 years. It's called the QI-TAM case, where whistleblowers can bring a suit against an entity if government or taxpayers have been cheated. And his contention and another scientist who filed with him was, we've all been cheated because CDC was buying a bad vaccine. But believe it or not, the court found, didn't really rule on the fraud or the alleged fraud. The court just said, hey, CDC knew the vaccine's problems and bought it anyway. So there was no fraud because CDC knew about everything. So nothing happens all the time. He spent like exposing all of this.
They acknowledged it was flawed, but said they bought it anyway.
Yep. And because of that, there was no fraud because it's not as though CDC was misled. They understood the problems with the that the vaccine was having at the time.
You know, this almost reminds me, do you remember the movie The Fugitive, remake of the TV show with Tommy Lee Jones? And
sure do.
The gist of the show is that a scientist at a healthcare company had shown that the information that was used to justify bringing the drug to market was falsified. And he ended up getting killed. And then, of course, they were going to frame Harrison Ford for it. But, I mean, the bottom line, it's about falsifying information and everyone's playing along except a brave whistleblower. So I hope people watch this. Cheryl, thanks very much for doing this. A special, special episode of Full Measure this Sunday, Como 4, 10 a.m. Don't miss it.
On Tuesday, Trump swore 13-year-old cancer survivor DJ Daniel into the Secret Service. Aww.
Oh, thank you.
And as expected, the next day, DJ received an email from Elon Musk demanding that he list five things he's already accomplished. Or he's fired! You're gone, DJ!
While you're talking about Elon Musk, we had a wonderful conversation with Steve Moore where we played this short 30-second excerpt of Harry Enten from CNN examining a neighboring network's poll, CBS, about wasteful spending and Doge. Now, Doge, every time you see Doge, it's always a story about, you know, they're ransacking databases. They're throwing people out of work. Cancer research is being canceled. Veterans feel absolutely betrayed, et cetera, et cetera. So, boy, how are Americans feeling about this Doge effort to cut government spending?
This, to me, was one of the more shocking figures that I saw. Made me go, wait a minute, hold on one second. Whoa, Americans on Trump and Joe's efforts. Musk and Doge should influence government spending and operations. Look at this. 54%. The majority say that he and they should. How about approve of Trump trying to cut staff at government agencies? Again, you get a majority here. 51%. So, yeah, Elon Musk might not be that popular, but these cuts and the idea of spending cuts, at least within the federal government and cutting at government agencies, that actually has majority support. I was truly surprised by this, Kate, but the numbers are the numbers.
And here's why. Because Americans get it. Americans feel, the rest of America feels the way you do. Okay, they get it. They see government waste every day, not just at the federal level, but they see government waste every day. Now, bureaucracy is the enemy of efficiency and cost efficiency. But in the private sector, there's an incentive to get rid of bureaucracy, or at least to try and keep it from building up too high. And that is, if you have too much bureaucracy, well, then that goes against company profits, that goes against dividends, that goes against what shareholders want, that goes against being able to pay your workers more because you've got so much bureaucracy, and it means you might serve your customers less effectively. So there's an incentive in the private sector to try and keep an eye on bureaucracy from growing out of control. Where's the incentive to do that in the public sector? In fact, you could argue that there's an incentive to keep building bureaucracy because, for one thing, it means a little less accountability. for employees so they don't have to worry so much about being blamed when things don't go right. And, you know, everyone who is a government manager, you know, wants to have a growing fiefdom. And so it's understandable that more employees would be a sign of their increasing importance. So Americans get it. They know that government is too bureaucratic and too inefficient, and that, you know, as they say, it's next to impossible to fire someone in government. Well, until Elon Musk and Donald Trump came along. So, again, think about all the publicity. Think about all of the stories you see in the newspapers and the television news stories that you watch. You would think that DOGE is going after vital government programs and cutting deeply into the muscle of what government does. The Democrats are hitting this drum, banging on this drum incessantly. But once again, Americans get it. And they're telling pollsters, no, we think that DOGE is going after waste. Again, back to Harry Enten at CNN.
Yeah, what do they think they're actually cutting? Democrats want to argue that the type of spending that Musk is cutting is mainly necessary programs, but that comes in at just 36%. The wasteful spending actually wins the plurality here at 42%, according to a recent Washington Post Ipsos poll. And I think that is the reason why you see that when it comes to Musk and DOGE, you see, in fact, the majority believe he should have some influence because they believe, the plurality believe, that he is cutting wasteful spending, not necessary programs that Democrats are arguing.
That is stunning. That did surprise me, because look at how the media are covering DOGE. Look at the angle they come at. The angle is always people being victimized by cuts are speaking out. That's the angle that most of the media's coverage approaches this story from. And yet, a plurality, 42% say, no, he's going after waste. Only 36% are buying off on, oh, he's cutting necessary government spending. So just as Americans kind of saw through the media coverage in many cases during the 2024 election, they're doing the same thing when it comes to how the media are covering the Trump administration. They're seeing through the coverage. What about the idea that the federal government has grown too big?
How are Americans feeling about the size of the government?
Yeah, so what is exactly going on here? What is sort of driving these numbers underneath? Government is doing too much or too little. Back in 2020, when Trump lost re-election, 54% said too little. By the time he won re-election in 2024, look at that. Too much won the majority at 55%. It was the inverse. So,
whoa, think about that. Think about that. Government's doing too little. Or rather, government is doing too much. In 2020, only 44% of Americans felt that way. By 2024, 55%. That is a huge sea change in public sentiment about the government doing too much. Here is Harry Enten's final sign-off here.
I think there's this real push from the American public to want spending at the U.S. government to drop, and I think that's part of the reason why they're giving Musk and DOGE that majority, at least at this point, when it comes to his influence over federal government.
They're giving him running room on this.
Yes, they're giving him running room, but again, this despite the fact that Elon Musk, who has been ceaselessly attacked on all fronts. Remember, last Saturday, there were protests throughout America in front of hundreds and hundreds of Tesla dealerships throughout the country. five right here in the Puget Sound area. They weren't protesting Trump. They were protesting Elon Musk. So Elon Musk has received unsparingly imbalanced condemnation and criticism. And he doesn't care. This is someone who really is secure in who he is and what he's trying to do. He doesn't care. He's going to solve this problem. And he is already making a lot of headway. But despite the fact that his own popularity stands a lot to be desired, despite all of the negative, wall-to-wall negative media coverage of Doge and ongoing condemnation and demonization of Elon Musk and Doge from Democrats in the House and Senate and much throughout the media, the American people still want Doge to succeed. That's a pretty big deal. That is very, very interesting. Okay, so let's go from a pleasant, that is a pleasant surprise to me. Let's go to another pleasant surprise. Bob Ferguson. Bob Ferguson is doing it again. He's reversing a irresponsible liberal left position taken by Jay Inslee, this one on the conversion of perfectly fine sailing vessels into hybrid electric status, despite the fact that it would take almost 3 years to do so.
Today I'm announcing that we are delaying the hybrid electric conversion for those remaining two state ferries.
They're not throwing out the hybrid plans altogether in favor of only diesel vessels. Changes to the Wenatchee will carry on as planned. Thursday at Coleman Dock, Governor Ferguson said it should be completed by June, but there's been some serious delays in that effort. The original promise of 1 year has become nearly two, and that's just time they can't afford with the World Cup on the horizon.
The increase in demand caused by these major events will, of course, put additional stress on an already strained system.
Ferguson says for that reason, we can't take our two biggest and busiest boats out of the mix for hybrid conversion. The Tacoma and the Puyallup are what's called Jumbo Mark II vessels, holding up to 2,500 passengers and 200 cars at one time.
We know the current schedule will take them out of the water for major upcoming events like the World Cup. We don't want that to happen.
So Jay Inslee was perfectly willing. Jay Inslee, whose record on the ferry service is the worst in state history. Since we replaced the private sector ferry service in the 1940s or early 50s with a state-run ferry system, Jay Inslee's record, and it's easy to measure, on-time performance, missed sailings, the average wait for people to take a ferry boat, particularly in the summertime. Jay Inslee's performance was abysmal. And what was his priority? Boats in the water, getting people to where they're going? No. Taking boats out of commission to convert them to electric so that we could save the planet. Again, just cheap virtue signaling that wouldn't have done anything to change the Earth's temperature. But again, Jay Inslee was an ideologue. And Bob Ferguson is saying, wait a minute, we can't have yet another summer of nightmarish service. We need to have these boats in the water. We need to get people to where they're going to quicker. The mayor of Bremerton was with Ferguson, and the mayor was very pleased.
The lack of service has been a crisis felt by residents of Bremerton who have lost jobs and face significant financial impacts.
The mayor of Bremerton, also at the press conference, agrees this announcement of the governor's would be a game changer for his community, because for years now, that route has been reduced to a single boat.
Residents and our veterans will also be able to keep medical appointments they once had to cancel or reschedule because of a lack of ferry service.
Okay, all of my listeners know this from radio legend Mark Christopher. He takes that Bremerton boat, well, when he can. And it's
South Worth or Bremerton, but
it's ridiculous that a major run from Seattle to Bremerton was down to one boat. Again, it's ridiculous. But this illustrates the problem and the lack of priority of improving customer service. Again, you're supposed to have a ferry service to serve your customers, something that Jay Inslee completely neglected. Here's one ferry rider who lives on Bainbridge Island.
You know, I don't know enough to know whether that's great news, but it seems like a decision was made to delay some progress in the name of consistent service. So I'm all for that.
And here's another woman. This one sells real estate, telling Fox 13 that
it's actually the same gal.
Oh, is it the same gal?
I just was struck by her comment there. She seems to typify the regular King County voter. I don't know what I'm voting for. I'm just voting with the group. She doesn't seem to apply any critical thinking to what's gone wrong with the ferries and how that plays into other political candidates, political issues.
But then she kind of lets on that, you know, the status quo isn't working for me.
I met Julie Miller parked in line after the news broke. After living 8 years on Lopez Island in the San Juans, and more recently, the past 2 decades on Bainbridge, she'll tell you.
A lot of ferry anxiety, honestly, because the islands are so remote.
She's excited that there could be 18 boats back on the water this summer, like there were before the lockdowns.
Post-COVID, it's been a really different story. Ferries down, delays.
As a real estate broker, she's felt the pinch caused by delays. Buyers hesitant to commit to island life because of a lack of consistency.
Yeah, again, and it was left to neglect. It was the ferry service was deliberately allowed to get like this. Remember, Jay Inslee, more than happy to fire ferry workers who almost all work outside because they didn't get vaccinated against COVID, even though many of them could show proof that they had had COVID. So they had essentially vaccinated themselves from within. And then when COVID passed, he refused to rehire them. And even though he had these shortages, and then he wants to take vessels out of the water and convert them. Just absolute ineptitude, absolute incompetence. And kudos to Bob Ferguson for changing gear and reversing course and changing gear and getting things moved back in the right direction. Again, another happy surprise for yours truly.
Better late than never.
One East Side city, coincidentally, the one I happen to live in, is taking a very proactive approach to getting a little tougher on low-level crime. And here's what I'm talking about. In Bellevue, shoplifting cases have jumped 37% in 2 years. 37% increase in 2 years. Those are reported shoplifting cases. As you know, a lot of companies don't even report shoplifting. Over nearly 1,000 reported vehicle prowling going on. Now, by the way, I should say, you know, not all vehicle prowls are reported to police. My car was prowled a couple of years ago. Maybe it was about 3 years ago, but they didn't take anything of value. Well, they emptied the change drawer.
So they busted the window and...
No, they didn't break the window. The car was unlocked.
Oh, I see. Okay.
as someone had just been in the car and they emptied the change drawer, and I opted not to report it. But a lot of people don't report, but nearly 1,000 incidents last year. They actually, in Bellevue, they do what Seattle's prosecutors were famous before Ann Davison was elected for not doing, and that is choosing to prosecute cases. They do it almost 90% of the time. But nearly 40% of the people they've arrested for shoplifting were repeat offenders. So on Tuesday, the Bellevue City Council is going to consider a new ordinance. It's being pushed by Council Member Jared Neuenhaus, who we've had on the show before, that would impose mandatory minimum sentences for repeat offenders of shoplifting and vehicle prowling. And here's what it would be. Again, keep in mind, in Seattle, remember when Eric Johnson did his famous show, the most watched show in Seattle history of any kind, the documentary Seattle is Dying? It was literally seen millions and millions of times, both online and on the air. And you saw these people who were arrested dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and they would either be just released, or maybe they do 48 hours and released and go right back to what they're doing. Well, in Bellevue on Tuesday, they will say that if you have been convicted at least twice before of shoplifting or vehicle prowling, and they catch you a third time, you will do 30 days in jail. You will get a minimum jail term. Now, they have a community court in Bellevue that could serve for the first time offenders as, or those who fall into the net, as an alternative for seeking rehabilitation. But the bottom line is they have figured out in Bellevue what I've been telling you for a long, long time, and which is part of the core of Three Strikes You're Out, which, full disclosure, as you know, I was the co-author and leader of America's first Three Strikes You're Out law. And that was passed by the people, not by the legislature. The legislature, just like this year's legislature, the legislature wouldn't even give it a hearing. But we got it passed, and the argument that we made to the voters was a significant amount of violent crime is committed by a small number of repeat offenders. Prolific offenders are disproportionately committing a hellacious amount of crime. That is true of violent crime. It is true of non-violent crime. It is true of car theft. You've got, yeah, sometimes someone steals a car, joyrides. But sometimes you also have people who are going from car to car to car. When they arrest someone, they see all of the accoutrements of someone working at their trade, breaking into cars and stealing them. So if you want to get tough on crime, the smart way to play it, the smart thing to do, is focus on the bad guys who are forever committing crime, who are serial offenders, or who, even if they're not serial offenders, they'll do it when they think they can get away with it, which means they have no conscience. They're the only thing that would stop them are consequences. And Bellevue, to their credit, might be on the verge of saying, you know what? If you're an adult and you have been given fair warning and you have committed two previous offenses and now you commit a third, you're going away for at least 30 days. That's mandatory, 30 days minimum. That is smart, because what it tells criminals is if you do it in Bellevue, there will be consequences. So either don't do it at all, or you better do it somewhere else. And hopefully, the other places they do it, hopefully they will do three offenses equal 30 days. Now, the smart thing they did in Bellevue is they waited to see how this same concept worked in Marysville. Marysville, north of Everett. The police chief there, I think, used to be a Redmond police captain. And they enacted a similar law, again, that focuses on repeat offenders, people who got a break and went right on doing it anyway. And they got a second break, went right on doing it anyway. The third time they do it, no break. 30 days to think about it, or more. Again, this is common sense. This is reasonable. When you're out there continuing to commit crime, it means that you're not getting the message. You're not getting the memo. This new ordinance would literally be the memo. So we will try and get the councilman on the show on Tuesday and see about the prospects of passage, because I think this is a great idea. And in my capacity as VP of governance for a rather prominent company in that town, I think I'm going to testify in favor of it. I'll say, by the way, if you're wondering how this works, we have the same concept in law when it comes to violent crime, and it works really well. And if the Democrats would stop watering down three strikes you're out, it would work even better. So anyway, we continue to move in the right direction. Oh, by the way, did you hear, the Paramount has been staging the wonderful Broadway musical Hamilton.
Right. Okay. The hip-hop musical.
Yeah. And yeah. Which I've seen three times, and it's wonderful.
I've not seen it in person. I've seen the whatever.
Yeah.
You Disney see, version production, whatever
yeah.
they
Yeah, they put to they filmed the stage yeah. version. It is entertaining. It is educational. It is inspirational. Heck, I don't even mind the cultural appropriation. Thomas Jefferson didn't look like that. Anyway, no, the bottom line, it is a wonderful and wonderful Broadway musical, one of the best ever. So the producer of Hamilton announced that he's canceling upcoming shows at the Kennedy Center because Donald Trump has taken control of the Kennedy Center Board of Trustees and has replaced most of the members who are on the board there. The producer wrote that political disagreements and debate are vital expressions of democracy, which is what you would expect someone to say when they are a Broadway musical having to do with our founders of democracy in this country. These basic concepts of freedom are at the very heart of Hamilton. However, some institutions are sacred and should be protected from politics. The Kennedy Center is one such institution. The Kennedy Center has come under fire precisely because of politics. But here's the question I have. Who does this hurt? I mean, who goes to see Hamilton in Washington, D.C.?
Probably a bunch of Democrats or people that would support Democrats.
Let me just guess that 80% plus of the people who would have gone to see Hamilton at the Kennedy Center are probably Democrats. So if you want to boycott the Kennedy Center and not bring Hamilton to an audience of overwhelmingly Democratic audience goers, okay. I don't know how that hurts Donald Trump. But again, this shows the short-term thinking, the tantrum-like thinking of people on the left.